Chapter 7. Perfecting the Penis. When it was first exhibited in the early 1990s, the artist Jeff Koons' Made in Heaven sparked a storm of controversy. Across a series of photographic canvases, technicolor sculptures and glass figurines, Koons and the artist and performer Ilona Stalla, or Cicciolina, were depicted engaging in a range of sex acts in scenes evoking a kitsch porn film. While the explicit sex unsettled some, the appropriation of religious themes discomforted others. Some pieces mimicked images from the Sanskrit Kama Sutra, while others referenced the biblical story of Adam and Eve. Koons explained that Made in Heaven was a response to Masaccio's famous fresco in the Brancacci Chapel in Florence, showing the expulsion from the Garden of Eden, in which Adam and Eve's intense shame and anguish are heart-wrenchingly portrayed in their agonised facial expressions and body language. "I was very moved by it," Koons said in an interview, and it prompted him to create what he described as a body of work that is kind of about after the fall, but all of this guilt and shame is removed. Whether he succeeded or not is another matter. But his goal was particularly well illustrated in the exhibition by a large polychromed wooden sculpture called Jeff and Ilona, 1990. It presents the couple as the new Adam and Eve, lying on a flower-studded rock, around which is coiled a giant golden-scaled serpent. Dressed in diaphanous bridal lingerie, Ilona, or Eve, is arched on her back, her legs slightly parted, her arms above her head, her mouth open, her eyes closed. Jeff, or Adam, is naked, his body stretched out alongside hers, his stiffened penis against her thigh. Raised up on his arms, he gazes down at Ilona, or Eve, his facial expression caught somewhere between enchantment and voyeurism. Melding sex and religion into subversive form is nothing new. But Koons' reinterpretation of the so-called fall also offered a rare and important contribution to Western art. In his naked self-presentation as Adam, he seemingly, if inadvertently, rendered the first man circumcised. Given the concern with nudity and body covering in the biblical story of Adam and Eve, the primeval couple's exposed genitalia have rarely been depicted in Jewish and Christian art across the ages. And in those unusual examples in which Adam's penis is shown, usually in European works, he appears to be equipped with a foreskin, reflecting the common assumption throughout the Christianized West that the newly created man came from the earth of Eden, complete. But among Jewish communities, for whom male circumcision was divinely ordained, it had long been a more complex, serious matter. Did God create Adam circumcised or with a foreskin? The answer would reveal just as much about God's penis as it would about Adam's genitals. This ancient debate was prompted by the centrality of male circumcision to Jewish perceptions of the relationship between God and his people, an exclusive bond formalised in the Torah as a covenant and specifically idealised in God's commandment to the great ancestor, the righteous Abraham, in the book of Genesis. "This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your offspring after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. You shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a mark of the covenant between me and you." In the biblical story of the religious past, the sign of the covenant is the circumcised penis, and Abraham is the first man to be circumcised. In this legend, it's said to be a ritual that marks him as tamim, whole or unblemished, and worthy to walk with God. But if circumcision marked the special covenantal relationship between God and man, the thought that Abraham's forebear, Noah, had been uncircumcised was perplexing. After all, he too had walked with God, the deity who had spared him from the flood, and to whom he was similarly bound in a covenantal relationship. Beyond this, it was even more absurd that Adam, the very first man himself, whom God had made and blessed as the pinnacle of his creation, should have been denied the mark of circumcision. And yet, in the Hebrew Bible, neither Noah nor Adam is said to have forsaken his foreskin. As with many other theological conundrums, the problem was solved by careful rabbinic exposition of biblical texts. Noah, the rabbis declared in the 2nd century CE, was clearly born circumcised, for he's described in Genesis as Tamim, just like Abraham. But what of Adam? Crucially, the rabbinic answer to this question unveiled God's genitals in the starkest of ways. Adam, too, was born from the earth circumcised, for it is said, "And God created man in his own image." If Adam was made in the image of God, as is twice claimed in Genesis, he must have been circumcised, the rabbis reasoned, for God was circumcised too. This idea is unlikely to have been an innovative theological shift. It reflects instead much older and deeply held assumptions. The elevated religious status of male circumcision in God's own sacred texts rendered it unthinkable that he could have had a foreskin. Culturally, too, there may have been an ancient mythic precedent for divine circumcision. God's direct forerunner, the late Bronze Age deity Ael, appears to have undergone circumcision in a ritual preparing him for marriage and sex with the two goddesses he encountered at the seashore. In this Ugaritic myth, Ael sits enthroned, equipped with the phallic symbols of old age and infertility. In his hand, the staff of sterility. In his hand, the staff of widowhood. Ael's reversal of the lifelessness held in his hands is revealed in a ritual asserting his sexual fecundity. His foreskin appears to be removed and the wound wrapped by ritual specialists associated with the careful cultivation of sacred vineyards. Those who prune the vine pruned him. Those who bind the vine bound him. They let his tendril fall like a vine. Like a budding vine clipped into fruitfulness, so Ael's circumcised penis brings forth children in his new marriage, infant deities whose own genitalia, grapes and tendrils, are inspected by a birth goddess to ensure that they're in order. The extent to which this myth was known throughout the Levant is uncertain, but in the Gospel of John, composed around 100 CE, the viticultural image of circumcision is used to describe Jesus as the true vine who is pruned by his divine Father to bring forth Christ's fruitful disciples. And as late as the 4th century CE, the Christian apologist Eusebius of Caesarea was citing an ancient writer called Philo of Byblos, circa 70 to 160 CE, who recounts an even older, if convoluted, Phoenician myth in which Ael circumcises himself before sacrificing his only begotten son, Yedud, or Beloved, a story striking in its parallels to that of Abraham, who in Genesis similarly circumcises himself and then attempts to sacrifice his only begotten and beloved son, Isaac. As a form of body modification, male circumcision was well known throughout the ancient world, although not all societies practiced it. One of its earliest depictions appears in an ancient Egyptian tomb relief from Saqqara, the great necropolis of Memphis, and is dated to the period of the 6th dynasty, circa 2345 to 2181 BCE. Two naked young men each stand in front of a circumciser seated on the floor at his feet. With one hand, the circumciser gently pulls at the youth's flaccid penis. With the other, he carefully takes a tool to the tip of the penis. Annotations running across the relief present dialogues between the characters. "Hold him fast, do not let him faint," says one circumciser to an attendant restraining one of the young men. "I will do as you command," he responds. The other young man reaches out to place his hand on the head of his circumciser, perhaps to steady his nerves as well as his gait. "Sever, indeed thoroughly," says the man. "I will proceed carefully," replies his practitioner. While the precise purpose of circumcision in this relief goes unstated, accompanying hieroglyphs indicate the circumcisers are mortuary priests, initiating new members into their guild. As such, circumcision here appears to function as a body ritual manifesting a new social identity or religious status, enabling the circumcised to perform particular roles otherwise unavailable to them. Indeed, male circumcision in ancient or traditional societies tends to function in this way. Like other forms of religious body modification, including piercing, tattooing, scarification and cutting, male circumcision is a means of making the body. In contrast to the notion of the natural body as a body unchanged and unadorned, the peoples of ancient Southwest Asia and Egypt perceived the body as an unfinished, ongoing social project, subject to essential alteration, adjustment, and reformation. Temporary forms of body modification, including makeup, hairstyling, clothing, and ritual washing, as well as permanent alterations, helped make and remake the body in ways that materialized particular social identities and abilities. This understanding of male circumcision stands in contrast to the common misperception that the reduction or removal of the foreskin reflected ancient efforts to maximize genital hygiene, a concern replicated in a number of Western societies today, particularly in the United States and Canada, where circumcision is routinely performed on infant males, not as a religious ritual, but a medical convention. But there's little, if any, evidence to suggest that the ancient origins of circumcision lie with a concern about the potential health risks festering beneath the foreskin. Blame for this tenacious misperception largely falls on the Greek writer Herodotus. Writing in the mid-5th century BCE, he asserts that circumcision was originally a custom of the Egyptians who practiced circumcision for the sake of cleanliness, for they set cleanness above seemliness. But although Herodotus was famously declared the father of history, his travelogues turned instead on cultural caricature and parody. Consequently, his description of the Egyptian practice satirizes the clean nature of circumcision. To be clean was not to be hygienic, but to be a body ritually ready for presence or action in sacred space. This seems to be the context of circumcision in the Egyptian relief at Saqqara, and it's the way in which circumcision is presented in Genesis. When God instructs Abraham to circumcise himself and walk with him, the ritual is pitched as the modification necessary to render Abraham unblemished, or tamim. And the reason why the God of the Bible would perceive the foreskin to be a blemish likely lies with the power of his own penis. In ancient and traditional societies, circumcision is more usually performed on pubescent or near-pubescent males as a rite of passage, marking on their bodies the maturing of their reproductive sexuality and the transition from boyhood to manhood. But the reduction or removal of the foreskin is more than a symbol of shifting social status. In societies in which a meaningful distinction is drawn between the mysterious hiddenness of the inside of the body and the more visible, malleable aspects of its outside, rituals often serve to control or negotiate the interplay between the two. This is why social and religious regulations in traditional societies often accrue around the body's orifices. But the deliberate blurring of the distinction between the inside and the outside of the body is also powerfully transformative. Bringing the inside of the body out intensifies its social and religious force. In the religious imagination, traditional male circumcision falls into this category. It opens the penis, bringing the glands outside the body permanently, perhaps mimicking the exposure of the glands in an erection, and thereby enhancing the fertile potency of the penis. It's no wonder male circumcision was so central to ancient Judaism and its religious precursors. Just as God's penis manifested his life-giving powers, so too he rendered the penises of his male worshippers more fruitful in commanding circumcision. This is made explicit in his covenant with Abraham in Genesis. Yahweh promises to make Abraham the ancestor of a multitude by rendering him exceedingly fruitful, a prospect Abraham initially finds incredible, given that he's nearing 100 years old and his elderly wife, Sarah, has always been barren. But male circumcision is the means by which this covenantal blessing is to be brought about, miraculously gifting Abraham and Sarah not only with a son of their own, Isaac, but with generations of Abrahamic descendants, tracked in Jewish tradition via the newborn Isaac, rather than Ishmael, the patriarch's 13-year-old son born by the slave girl Hagar, who in the Bible is quickly rejected by his father after Isaac's birth. It's for this reason that the heightened fruitfulness of the circumcised penis is closely associated in the Hebrew Bible with the careful cultivation of agricultural fecundity. Maturing fruit trees are held to render a better quality and more bountiful crop if circumcised in their fourth year, much as Ael's circumcised penis was made fruitful by those who prune the vine at Ugarit. But the close paralleling of circumcised penises and fruiting trees also carries a more unsettling legacy, as the Phoenician myth of Ael's circumcision appears to have done. Just as the God of the Bible demanded his cut of the agricultural and animal harvest in the form of tithed offerings in his temples, so too he claimed his ancient right to a cut of the human crop. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and your sheep. 7 days he shall remain with his mother. On the 8th day you shall give him to me. But while a firstborn animal was to be sacrificed, male infants were to be rescued from death by means of circumcision, the modification of their penises physically marking God's claim to their bodies. Male circumcision not only brought life, but protected newborn males from sacrificial death, transforming a fertility ritual more usually performed on pubescent boys into a birth ritual. Such was the religious power of the circumcised penis that by the 5th century BCE, the priests of the Jerusalem temple had developed a complex set of regulations designed to tame its seminal discharge. Its potent fertility should only be used to bring legitimate life into the world. Sex outside marriage was discouraged. Sex with a kinsman's woman, whether wife, sister, mother or daughter, was abhorrent because it risked confusing patrimonial bloodlines. Sex with a foreign woman, who might well worship other gods, risked destabilizing the kinship cohesion of Yahweh's worshippers and undermined his exclusive claim to their children. And as we've seen, sexually penetrating another man, or an animal, or ejaculating onto the earth, was especially deviant, not for any clear moral objections, but probably because it meant that semen would be wasted, transgressing God's command that his people were to be fruitful and multiply. Enshrined in the Torah, these religious regulations were originally intended only for priests, but they would increasingly be assumed to apply to all male Yahweh worshippers in and beyond the Jerusalem temple. In an ancient society in which idealized masculinity was closely tied to the social and physiological performance of the penis, Jerusalem's religious elites considered the uncircumcised penis deficient, just as other body parts that did not function optimally, deaf ears, mumbling mouths, disloyal hearts, were also said to be uncircumcised. And if the uncircumcised penis was deficient, so too was its owner. He was perceived as physically, socially, and religiously defective, which is why some biblical writers are emphatic in their insistence that only the circumcised can participate in rituals devoted to Yahweh and count themselves among the people of God. This ideology would later go some way to constructing a distinctively masculinized ethnic identity of Yahweh worshippers within early Jewish societies. But its phallocentrism rendered those without functioning genitals or a penis to circumcise excluded from certain forms of worship and either temporarily or permanently marginalized in their communities. Women and alternatively gendered members of society, including those conventionally described as eunuchs and the genitally impaired, were increasingly seen as inherently flawed and potentially destabilizing in the religious world. Consequently, these lesser bodies demanded careful management, primarily, but not exclusively, by means of rituals understood to contain or counteract the social and religious dangers they manifested. Eunuchs had long enjoyed or endured a unique status across ancient Southwest Asia. Their specialized bodies rendered them powerfully equipped not only to cross boundaries between masculine and feminine spaces, but to traverse the ritualized thresholds of the cosmos so that they might step safely between divine and human spheres. And yet their mysterious liminality made them potentially dangerous, and they were feared and celebrated in equal measure. Among the masses, their fates were precarious, but within elite contexts, some eunuchs might be elevated to prestigious political and religious positions. Some were identified as eunuchs from birth, but many were castrated males, some voluntarily, some through coercion or force. If they survived castration, the resulting health complications made their lives expensive to sustain, rendering them luxury commodities and status symbols for their wealthy patrons or owners. Eunuchs literally embodied design the chic for royal courts and temples. It's in these elite settings that eunuchs most frequently appear in the Hebrew Bible. They're members of royal households performing important political, military, and religious roles. But in Judah, their lives changed in the 5th century BCE when the Persian Empire held sway across the region. Judah's defunct monarchy was replaced by a series of imperially appointed governors who oversaw the rebuilding of Jerusalem's temple. Its priesthood was reconstituted, and the city's burgeoning theocracy now ministered to a much reduced community. Against this backdrop, eunuchs' bodies became more problematic. Although most were equipped with a penis and some were able to have penetrative sex, their sterility rendered them a dry tree in a religious culture in which the fruitful phallus was ever more crucial. They were to be kept away from God's presence, although one of Yahweh's prophets promised that they would be granted compensatory access to sacred space in the form of a memorial stela, which would be pointedly erected in the temple and would be better than sons and daughters. For those members of society without a penis, matters of temple community membership were more complex, for their bodies deviated even further from the religious ideal of the circumcised male. Female circumcision appears not to have been a practice with which ancient Southwest Asian and Eastern Mediterranean societies were particularly familiar. Early evidence for the rite anywhere in this region is sporadic and sketchy at best, and tends to be filtered through the pejorative cultural bias of Greek and Roman writers, primarily discussing exotic Egyptian communities. Instead, Jerusalem's priests formalized the older tendency to restrict or exclude women from the male-dominated spaces and rituals of the temple, and countered the dangerous impact of their leaky bodies by prohibiting men from having sex with a menstruating woman. They also guarded male infants from the contaminating impact of their own female birth blood. Mothers and babies were to be considered unclean and kept away from both sacred space and those men who might enter it until their uncleanness had subsided and they'd performed the requisite purification rituals. If a woman bore a son, the blood of his circumcision on the 8th day countered the dangerous blood of his mother's body. The baby boy was made clean while she remained in a state of impurity for 33 days. If she birthed a daughter, however, a mother's uncleanness was intensified. Her body was highly toxic for 14 days, and she remained impure for a further 66 days. Essentially, the Hebrew Bible was born in a specialized scribal culture in which the circumcised penis was both the ultimate human manifestation of a divinely endorsed phallocentric masculinity and a bodily performance of normative, faithful devotion to God. This speaks to a hierarchy of human bodies built on relative and varying constructions of gender, including diverse shades of masculinities, deeply embedded within the religious traditions giving rise to early Judaism and Christianity. At the apex of this hierarchy was the circumcised male body, a body itself drawn on a divine paradigm, the body of God. As the cosmic creator who constructed human males in his own image, it was for many beyond theological doubt that God himself was circumcised and that this form of body modification among his male worshippers perfected their own penises, making their bodies whole, unblemished, and divinely fertile, as it had Abraham. Manhood. The paradigmatic divine penis inevitably extended into Christianity and onto the body of Jesus of Nazareth. Oddly, though, his is a body about which we know very little. For all its talk about Jesus, one of the most peculiar features of the New Testament is its apparent disinterest in what he looked like. Certainly, the writers of these texts offer various observations about the wounds inflicted on Jesus during his torture and execution and the nature of his resurrected body. But nowhere in the biblical canon is there a description of his physical features. Only one passing detail about the visual appearance of his body is given. Jesus' penis was circumcised. This in itself should come as no surprise. After all, Christianity began as a minor Jewish sect. Jesus of Nazareth was Jewish, as were most of his first followers. It was only natural that Jesus was assumed to have been circumcised. But the presumed religious realities of Jesus' personal life were all too often lost in the highly abstract theologies of Paul and other early Christian leaders, for whom the resurrected heavenly Christ was in many ways more important than Jesus the man. To a certain extent, the authors of the New Testament Gospels, composed after Paul's letters, tempered this abstraction by focusing on the earthly, human nature of Christ, offering tales of Jesus' life set in his own Jewish culture in Roman Palestine. But these tales also served to bolster first-century Christian theologies. As a subset of Judaism, earliest Christianity necessarily relied upon the Jewish scriptures to endorse its claims about Jesus' messianic and divine status. Consequently, selected Jewish cultural and religious preferences are used in the gospel accounts of the mysterious man from Nazareth to attest to his bona fide credentials as the alleged embodiment and fulfillment of both traditional Jewish teaching and practice. And for some Christians, there was no denying that this divine man's penis was appropriately circumcised. Authoritative confirmation was offered in the Gospel of Luke, in which Jesus is said to have been circumcised on his eighth day of life, in accordance with God's regulations in the Torah. Afterwards, when both he and his mother have emerged from the impurity of the birth, Jesus is taken to the Jerusalem temple to be presented to God because, as the author of Luke states, it's written in the law, or Torah, of the Lord, every firstborn male should be designated as holy to the Lord. In this early Christian tradition, at least, Jesus' circumcision functions in expected ways. It brings Jesus' body into anatomical line with the masculine, circumcised body of the God of the Jerusalem temple. But the sexualized fecundity promised by male circumcision would not bear fruit in the New Testament. Both the earthly Jesus of Nazareth and the risen heavenly Christ remain emphatically childless and celibate. Instead, the fruits of his circumcised penis are spiritualized. In the Gospel of John, as we've seen, they are disciples pruned from his vine by his divine Father. Meanwhile, in the letter to the Colossians, Christ's circumcision figuratively defleshes the base bodies of his followers, transforming them into spiritually charged believers destined for eternal life. In him also you were circumcised with a spiritual circumcision, by putting off the body of flesh in the circumcision of Christ. And when you were dead in trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made you alive together with him. The spiritualizing of circumcision was not only theologically fruitful, but socially strategic. In its early years, the Jesus movement was exhibiting the symptoms of an older cultural malaise suffered by its Jewish parent. Circumcision had become a problem. Evidence from as early as the 2nd century BCE indicates that some Jewish men within and beyond Judea, or Judah, were attempting to conceal or reverse their circumcisions. Traces of this practice are evident in 1 Maccabees, written in the late 2nd century BCE, in which a group of Jewish elites is roundly condemned for building a Greek gymnasium in Jerusalem and removing the marks of circumcision before exercising in the nude. It was an event similarly condemned by the historian Josephus, a Jewish Roman, who claims that the men of Jerusalem's gymnasium concealed the circumcision of their private parts in order to be Greeks even when unclothed. But Greek-style sporting etiquette was not the only motivation for the practice. It might also be triggered by religious conversion. Just as Gentile men across the Mediterranean were often circumcised when they joined diasporic Jewish communities, so those abandoning their traditional Jewish practices for Greco-Roman gods or Christian worship might seek uncircumcision. This is powerfully presented in the New Testament writings of Paul, in which he advises Jewish followers of Christ against epispasm, the physical reversal of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call circumcised? Let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call foreskinned? Let him not seek circumcision. As a circumcised Jewish convert to Christ, Paul himself may well have found the prospect of secondary genital modification unappealing. Although he gives no indication of precisely how Jewish men were reversing their circumcisions, other ancient sources suggest it could be achieved in two ways. The easiest method was a temporary and faintly implausible fix. Circumcision might be camouflaged by donning a sheath. But for those requiring a longer-lasting solution, the process was more complex and uncomfortable. Weights were attached to the skin at the neck of the penis shaft, piercing any residual remnants of the foreskin, so that it was stretched over the glands to cover as much of the head of the penis as possible. It's described in early rabbinic traditions as meshikat olah, drawing down the foreskin, and appears to have been sufficiently notorious that it rarely required further explanation. But it concerned Jewish leaders enough to institute a lasting change in traditional circumcision. By the mid-2nd century CE, rabbis were instructing circumcisers in their communities not only to cut back the bulk of the foreskin, but to split and peel away the underlying mucous membrane, which fully exposed the corona and prevented the stretching of vestigial skin over the glands. Known as perea, or revealing, it remains the standard method of traditional circumcision. The physical removal or reversal of male circumcision had more to do with wider Greco-Roman constructs of idealised masculinity than intra-Jewish religious resistance. For the Greek intelligentsia and their Roman beneficiaries, the perfect male body was the muscular nude form of the athlete, a corporeal manifestation of disciplined masculine beauty, teasingly caricatured in Aristophanes' Clouds as a rippling chest, radiant skin, broad shoulders, a wee tongue, a grand rump, and a petite dick. Crucially, the penis was to be generously foreskinned and the testicles present and intact. While circumcised men and various types of eunuchs were well known in the Greek and Roman worlds, their modified genitals often signalled an exotic or discomforting cultural otherness, no matter how Greek or Roman they were in any other way. Within this context, both male circumcision and castration tended to be perceived as a barbaric mutilation, potentially generating transgressive or uncontrolled sexual appetites. The two forms of genital modification were only marginally distinguished in the 2nd century CE, when forced castration was increasingly outlawed and the lucrative trade in congenital and voluntary eunuchs was subjected to tighter regulation in the Roman Empire. Against this backdrop, male circumcision was an inflammatory issue in some Christian communities, as New Testament texts suggest. This literature was written and shared by Greek-speaking Christians thoroughly immersed in their own Greco-Roman cultures, many of whom were growing increasingly hostile to the Jewish origins of their faith. Eventually, most forms of Christianity would abandon circumcision altogether, a position encouraged by Paul's letter to the Galatians, in which he claims that Christians are rendered the offspring of Abraham not by means of the body, but by their faith in Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, For all of you are one in Christ Jesus. And if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed, heirs according to the covenant promise. Some Christians today often interpret his words as a more democratized and even superior understanding of the traditional Jewish idea of covenant, a theological liberation from what they perceive to be the restrictive gender politics and ethnocentrism of Judaism. But this is mistaken. Paul was not rejecting circumcision, nor the validity of the Torah in which it was so keenly promoted. Nor was he calling for the emancipation of slaves, nor indeed for the elevation of women to a status equal to men, foreskinned or not. Rather, Paul was asserting that even the starkest of social distinctions were eclipsed by believers' shared identity in Christ Jesus. For this reason, he repeatedly argued, there was no need for people to seek a change in their social or cultural positioning. Hence his insistence that within a Christian community in which cultural descent of members varied, Gentile genitals should not be cut, while Jewish genitals could continue to be. Let each of you lead the life that the Lord has assigned, to which God called you, he wrote. This is my rule in all the churches. Ultimately, neither circumcision nor non-circumcision mattered to Paul, for penises were about to become redundant. With the imminent coming of the kingdom of God, there would be no need for mortal bodies and no need for sex. Instead, Christians would be returned to the celibate celestial state in which they had come to believe humans were originally created. But Christian theology has never been wholly successful at reconciling its heavenly aspirations with the material, bodily realities of human existence. Paul's lofty theology not only failed to quell early Christian disputes about the religious significance of circumcised penises, but it also did little to diminish a growing appetite for any fleshy fragments Christ might have left behind before his ascension to heaven. By the 4th century CE, believers had grown increasingly interested in Jesus' own circumcision and the fate of his foreskin. In a world in which the mortal remains of holy men and heroes were already venerated in Jewish and Greco-Roman cultures, the purported material fragments of Jesus' earthly life, from the splinters of his cross to his bloodied death shroud, were naturally believed to hold magical powers. A trade in holy relics spread across Christendom, encouraged by legends assuring believers that bits of Christ's body remained in the world. Proof of the continued existence of Jesus' foreskin was firmly attested in the so-called Arabic Infancy Gospel, circa 5th century CE, an influential text drawing on colourful traditions circulating about Christ's early life. It includes the story of a midwife present at the birth and circumcision of Jesus, who sagaciously stores his severed foreskin in an alabaster container of precious oil and gives it to her pharmacist's son, a purveyor of powerful potions and lotions. Although she instructs him not to sell it, it's procured by the sinful woman who anoints Jesus' feet when he's an adult, a canny detail reassuring concerned Christians that the oil touching Jesus' body had already been sanctified by the presence of his holy foreskin within it. The text neglects to tell its readers what subsequently became of Christ's foreskin, but no matter, for it began to pop up with astonishing frequency across the Christian world. East and West, increasing numbers of churches, bishops, mystics and pilgrims all claimed to be in possession of what would come to be known as the Holy Prepuce. By the 13th century, the most famous of Christ's foreskins was believed to be lodged in Rome. It was claimed that a heavenly hand had presented it to Charlemagne, circa 742 to 814 CE, as he prayed in Jerusalem's Holy Sepulchre while on pilgrimage. He had taken it to Western Europe, enshrining it first in his imperial chapel at Aix-la-Chapelle, now Aachen in Germany, and then at Charroux in France, before gifting it to Pope Leo III in return for his coronation as the first Holy Roman Emperor on Christmas Day 800 CE. Leo is said to have kept it in a sacred chest of cypress wood along with other earthly remains of Christ's body, including his umbilical cord and death blood. When Rome was sacked in 1527 during the wars of Pope Clement VII and the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, the holy prepuce disappeared, although this did not prevent its continued appearance in countless churches throughout Christendom. It was last seen in 1983 in the small Italian town of Calcutta, where it had apparently been venerated for centuries. And yet, shortly before its ritual exhibition at its annual festival, it again disappeared. The local priest claimed sacrilegious thieves had ransacked his home, stealing the shoebox at the back of his wardrobe in which the holy relic resided for safekeeping. But many believed it was snatched by dark forces within the Vatican. For centuries, paying pilgrims had flocked to see the holy prepuce at sacred sites across medieval Europe, seemingly unconcerned by its mysterious ability to be installed in several places at the same time. After all, some said, it was further proof of the miraculous ability of Jesus' body to regenerate and multiply without diminishing in power, a phenomenon attested by the repeated consumption of Christ's flesh and blood in the Eucharist. Others, however, had long suspected it was evidence of a racket in relics. To counter forgers and sceptics, and no doubt boost church coffers, the authenticity of a holy prepuce might be certified by reputable Christian mystics, whose visionary encounters with the divine enabled them to furnish cathedrals and churches with curatorial notes on their relics. But validation might also be sought by means of the taste test. A physician would be appointed by local clergy to nibble a piece of the latest relic to confirm whether it was vegetal matter, animal leather, or human foreskin. Its sanctity might also be confirmed by its flavour. Sacred relics were believed to give off a sweet scent. They surely tasted sweet too. This was indeed the experience of the 13th century Beguine mystic Agnes Blambakin, who claimed Christ's foreskin tasted gloriously sweet. Agnes was regularly swallowing the holy prepuce, which miraculously manifested itself on her tongue when she received communion on the annual feast of the circumcision. She reported its consistency was alike the skin in an egg, and that when she felt compelled to put her finger in her mouth and touch it, that little skin went down her throat on its own, filling her limbs with a sweetness so great it appears to have triggered an orgasmic out-of-body experience. Intimate encounters with the holy prepuce often took on an erotic, fetishistic allure. In the 14th century, Christ's foreskin wrapped itself around the finger of Catherine of Siena, an unenclosed nun and mystic who believed she'd been wedded to Christ in a vision. This in itself wasn't altogether unusual. Catherine shared with many other celibate devotees an understanding that her intensely intimate relationship with Christ was a sacred marriage. But for Catherine, that marriage was marked by the holy prepuce she saw encircling her finger like a wedding band. "You espouse our souls to you with the ring of your flesh," she declared in a passionate prayer to her divine husband. Catherine was a great letter writer and repeatedly reminded other brides of Christ in her correspondence that we do not marry Christ with rings of gold or silver, but with the ring of Christ's foreskin, given in the circumcision and accompanied by pain and the shedding of blood. For both Agnes Blambakin and Catherine of Siena, as for other Christian thinkers, the bloodied foreskin was not only a treasured earthly remnant of the divine body, but a material manifestation of the transformative, salvific death of Christ. Cast as the first painful wound inflicted on his innocent body, Christ's circumcision anticipated the piercing of his hands and feet and the lancing of his side as he died in agony upon the cross. But the mystical, erotic experiences of these pious women also reflect a deep and devout desire to encounter the corporeal realities of Christ upon and within their own bodies. Like those priests and pilgrims who venerated the holy prepuce, Agnes and Catherine sought to enflesh the religious realities of their convictions in ways the more doctrinal, immaterial abstractions of Christian theology and its transcendent otherworldly God could not. It was not only relics that helped to perpetuate the vernacular engagement with Christ's fleshy genitals in the West. The circumcision of the infant Jesus became a stock feature of art across medieval and Renaissance Europe. But the visual portrayal of the cleansing cut of his Jewish past was heavily influenced by its common reinterpretation as a precursor to his passion. Blended with the virulent anti-Semitism of the West, artistic representations of Christ's circumcision often portrayed a chubby, white baby Jesus as the self-sacrificing victim of the bloodthirsty, hook-nosed Jewish circumcisers surrounding him. Frequently garbed in the imagined vestments of the ancient Jewish priesthood, or topped with the distinctive peaked hat that had become a conventional, malevolent marker of Jewishness in European art, these men are regularly depicted crowding around the child, leering at the large blade menacingly positioned at his tiny genitals. In some works, the ugly caricaturing of Jewish ritual was further embellished by the deliberate misgendering of the circumciser as a hideous, villainous woman. In the masculinist world of medieval and Renaissance Christianity, circumcision was still closely associated with castration. The Jewish mutilation of the genitals was therefore cast as a feminizing, sexually abusive wound, fating little boys to an unmanned adulthood. One example among many powerfully illustrates this. A depiction of Christ's circumcision in Guillaume de Dégouville's widely read trilogy, The Pilgrimage of Human Life, The Pilgrimage of the Soul, and The Pilgrimage of Jesus Christ, circa 1400, shows a startled infant Jesus raising his arm in an attempt to fend off the snarling woman looming over his genitals. Two other Jewish women huddle behind her, craning their necks to see the cut. By contrast, Jesus' parents stand at a distance behind him, Mary's hands raised in fretful, pleading protest. Mary's maternal concern for Jesus' penis was even more familiar in the wildly popular representations of the Madonna and Child, in which the naked infant was depicted sitting in her lap, her hand or fingers modestly covering his genitals. But in several Renaissance examples of this scene, Mary's hand does not veil his penis. Instead, she gestures towards it, holds it between her fingers, or gently fondles it in ways indicative of its very deliberate public exhibition. In some instances, the child's penis appears to serve as an object of veneration to other figures in the composition, who gaze upon it in pious, wondrous adoration. The Madonna's emphatic exhibition of Jesus' genitals not only serves to underscore his fleshy humanity, but foregrounds the mediatory role of the divine penis in Christ's relationship with the world. Mary's assertive exposure of her son's penis is often met with his responsive approval in paintings employing what art historian Leo Steinberg affectionately calls the chin chuck. As the Madonna presents Jesus' genitals, the Christ child reaches out his little arm and touches his mother's chin. It's a much older artistic motif of erotic endorsement adapted in medieval Christian art to communicate the complex theological intimacy of Christ and the Virgin. She's not only his mother, but his chosen heavenly consort. The celibacy of their union tempers the genital sexualization of Christ in these images. But this is disrupted in certain Renaissance portrayals of the Pietà, another stock scene in Western Christian iconography, mirroring with forceful intent the intimacy of the Madonna and Child. In these images, Christ is again held in the Virgin's lap, but this time he's the sexually mature man who's been killed and brought down from the cross. In anguish, his mother cradles his naked, broken body, his groin strategically covered by his dead hand or draped with fabric. But in some versions of the Pietà, Christ's penis is startlingly erect beneath his loincloth. A vivid example is an early 16th century painting attributed to the Flemish artist Willem Kai. A bearded, muscular Christ lies dead across his mother's lap, his hand pierced with the gaping wound of a nail. A heavily veiled Mary lifts his head to her own as she bends to kiss his lips. Christ's pelvic and thigh muscles are sharply defined, drawing the gaze to his loincloth, which barely covers his groin. Beneath it, his penis swells into an erection, lifting the folds of the fabric. Christ might be dead, but his penis promises his restoration to life. It's an intense image of a powerfully sexualized masculine virility, similarly conveyed in contemporaneous portrayals of the Man of Sorrows, the name given to a common devotional image focusing on the bloodied physicality of Christ's suffering, torture, and death. One of the most astonishing is a Ludwig Krug engraving, circa 1510 to 32, in which Christ sits between his mother and the disciple John, looking straight at the viewer. On his head is a thick crown of thorns. The spear slash in his side is clearly visible. He shows the viewer the nail wounds in his hands, which are bound together with rope. A wide loincloth is wrapped around his waist, but it rises up from his groin to wind tightly around Christ's extraordinarily large, thick erection. In this engraving, the physical realities of Christ's death are vividly countered by his active, living corpse. He sits up and raises his hands. His open eyes reveal an all-seeing gaze, and his penis is powerfully erected into life. It's a profoundly theological image. Single and celibate, asexual and child-free. In the text-centric modern West, we've become so accustomed to the neutered Christ of the New Testament that it's difficult to comprehend or even perceive the veneration of the sexualized virility of this divine man within those societies preceding our own. But across the visual cultures of late antique, medieval, and Renaissance Europe, close attention to Christ's genitals in legends, relics, icons, and artwork served not only to highlight his maleness and his humanity, but his death-defying divine virility. Whether newly circumcised, prepubescent, or maturely erect, the divine penis of the post-biblical Christ inherited the sexualized, life-giving agency of the phallic body of the God of the Bible, with one important exception. In the religious imagination, Christ tended to remain tantalizingly chaste and sexually innocent. The God of the Bible did not.